There's a light that still shines from the faces of those near. In the night they will stand and cry in hope and in fear. Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say,
afternoon to all of our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. We start off with a spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Back to Reality. The main theme of this program is Muslims living in a non-Islamic country, sharing their experiences, their lived experiences with the audience. That will be followed by Iran Today to round up this hour's program. Iran Today presents the latest advances in science and technology in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It also highlights the latest business and economic developments in Iran.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, if the Israeli occupation entity had enjoyed the impunity and political cover of the U.S. for over the years, it would either no longer exist, be a fraction of what it is, and generations of its leadership would have been targeted and incarcerated for egregious violations of international law, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But what we see today is a red carpet treatment of a wanted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the White House. Not only is his arrest warrant ignored, the four judges who issued it at the International Criminal Court, they get sanctioned. And the UN rapporteur on Occupy Palestine, who's documented all the war crimes in Gaza for over 22 months, she gets sanctioned. And ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan also faced sanctions back in February. And this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, let's begin with this report.
As global institutions pursue accountability for Israeli war crimes in Gaza, the United States responds not with support for justice, but with imposing sanctions and punitive measures. Washington is shielding its ally, the Israeli regime, from scrutiny and clearly emphasizes its unwavering support in the face of international law.
As President Trump and members of Congress roll out the red carpet for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a war criminal who will be remembered as one of the monsters of modern history.
So, is justice being served or silenced? In February, the U.S. sanctioned ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan after he issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant. Their charges were war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Later on, Khan was banned from entering the U.S. and his assets were frozen. Then in June, four ICC judges were sanctioned for authorizing investigations into Israeli actions. The judges were accused of abusing power. Then the UN and ICC condemned the move as a threat to judicial independence. The latest target, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. Her July 2025 report accused Israel of committing genocide.
Following nearly 6 months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide.
The U.S. imposed sanctions on her, froze her assets, and established travel ban after she criticized European nations for granting airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu for his trip to Washington, despite his ICC active arrest warrant. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Albanese's efforts as illegitimate and shameful.
I've been smeared, attacked, I've received threats, and this has been relentless for the past 16 months. Me and my family, we have been all defamed and threatened, including my children.
International institutions are facing mounting challenges in their efforts and at serving justice and accountability. The tension between sovereign interests and established global norms prompts critical evaluation. Washington's blind support for Israel and shielding the child killer regime constitutes a blatant deviation from long-standing principles of international law.
And now for your guests. Mr. Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal, Canada. And Daniel Tobolik, human rights lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, out of the U.S. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Yves, we'll start with you out there in Montreal. Yves, giving the Israeli entity political cover, it's one thing, Yves, but this outright demonizing, targeting, and sanctioning people with a mandate to adjudicate or document crimes, you're taking on a whole different task here. Help us make a sense of what the U.S. is doing by targeting these people, including U.N. employees here.
Yeah, the scope Washington's willing to go in terms of enabling the Holocaust in Gaza is absolutely remarkable. This latest move is obviously an indication of that, and the UN should be moved out of New York. I mean, this is just another step down this pathway of targeting anyone, even if they are representing the whole international community, to help Israel commit more and more war crimes and slaughter against Palestinians. It's remarkable, but at this point, we have just seen one after another after another after another step down this path that Washington and its major allies have pursued in enabling Israel's crimes.
Right, and Daniel, welcome to the conversation here, and thank you for your patience. And also your initial thoughts as well, please, Daniel, on how the U.S. continues to kill the messenger here when the message and those involved in it, they encompass the most despicable crimes of wars against, crimes against the humanity that this generation has witnessed.
Yeah, well, you know, a number of people pointed out the incredible irony that in the same week that the U.S. has now recognized and lifted all sanctions on the al-Qaeda leader of Syria, al-Jalani, and removed his group from the list of terrorists, has decided instead to sanction human rights activists and leaders. It really says everything about where the U.S. is today. They are the enemy of international law, the enemy of human rights. And as an American, I couldn't be more disappointed.
Thank you, Daniel. And now, Ease, this week, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, she named 48 companies that are using the Gaza genocide to fine-tune their products and make billions from the onslaught. Tech giants, weapons manufacturers, heavy equipment manufacturers, banks, even charities, there, Ease, imploring them to boycott working with Tel Aviv. She also asked European countries just the other day to not allow their airspace to be used by Benjamin Netanyahu, a wanted war criminal, to get to the States. And he gets there, ultimately, and then Donald Trump sanctions her, right, for this week's and other work that she's done in the past. I mean, in a just world, Ease, she deserves an award on her work for the Palestinian people, not the kind of scrutiny she's getting.
Yeah, well, Netanyahu suggesting Trump should get the Peace Prize for bombing Iran. Obviously, Albanese should be in any sane world would be a thousand times more proper candidate for that. I think that that contrast is just is remarkable that they. She's demonized, even though she's the one combating genocide. I think that the probably part of this timing is that was the report was quite impactful. I know here in Quebec, it got a lot of attention. The fact that the major pension fund in Quebec is invested in genocide, and she cited that in her report. Some of the stuff on the Caisse de dépôt here in Quebec. And that got a lot of attention, and I think that was probably, quite frustrating from Israel's perspective, and from Washington's perspective. So that's maybe one of the explanations for this timing of these sanctions. But yeah, in a big picture, I mean, it's the idea that the person who is putting everything on the line. In a sense, at least in the mental health, her career on the line, not like Palestinians in Gaza putting everything on the line, but that they're targeted for doing everything they can to expose and to oppose these crimes, and then the criminal is celebrated in Washington for multiple days is quite a contrast.
And Daniel, your thoughts on the Trump administration sanctioning someone who has, to Eve's point, almost put practically everything on the line to carry out such a tedious task, Daniel, of documenting all of and opening the world's eyes to Israel's war crimes in Gaza and occupied West Bank. Now, this report we just mentioned with the 48 companies you mentioned the other week, that report was called From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide, and that comes on the heels of another lengthy report. I'm just trying to outline how much time and energy she has exhausted on the Palestinian, especially this 22 months of Gaza genocide. That comes on the heels of another report called Anatomy of a Genocide, Daniel. That was from March of 2024, and another report in October of 2024 called Genocide as Colonial Erasure. Now, in the latter, Albanese identifies how Israel is expanding its genocide from Gaza to the occupied West Bank. Israel is the outlaw in this Wild West gunfight, and Albanese, she's the sheriff. What does that make, Daniel, the U.S. here?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is the enabler of this genocide. And Francesca Albanese is playing, if I may use a biblical term, really a prophetic role by calling that out. And as you say, giving everything, her sacrificing herself. By the way, I think a special rapporteur, I don't think she even gets paid. Maybe gets like a dollar or something for her work. I mean, this is basically volunteer work she's doing to advocate for the Palestinian people, to condemn a genocide, which everyone should be condemning, and then to be punished for doing that with these sanctions is outrageous. Again, it says everything about the people punishing her, right? She is the one who should get a Nobel Peace Prize. That is a no-brainer, right? And if she doesn't, it will be just an outrage, right? But we live in a time that, frankly, someone like George Orwell couldn't even satirize, right? It satirizes itself. War is peace. Again, as my colleague Eves pointed out, that you have this ridiculous show at the White House where Netanyahu shows him a letter where he's been nominated for the Peace Prize. It reminds me of when Hitler was nominated for the Peace Prize. I mean, it's that crazy. But we live in an upside-down world in which, you know, a lot of people's moral compass does not point to due north anymore.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
World Eve, the targeting of Karim Khan, also ICC chief prosecutor, and his team for issuing these arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu's ex-war minister, Yoav Gallant, for crimes against humanity, including using food and starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Eve, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the ICC team. Please tell me what their crime exactly is here. Well, how do they deserve to get sanctioned? How is their issuance of these arrest warrants not praised and applauded instead?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the criticism is that they've been way too slow and they haven't moved forward on this, of course. They Karim Khan should be criticized for being way too passive in the face of Israel's violations of international law. But the Trump administration, goes after them like that. And I should say here, there's been two recent votes at the Human Rights Council, UN Human Rights Council, and the Canadian government, which claims to have been a big player in establishing the ICC and supports it, it has refused to endorse these two resolutions condemning these attacks against ICC officials. And in fact, previously, 5 years ago, I think it was in 2020, the Canadian government even sent a letter to the ICC, basically pressuring them, threatening the funding, Canada's funding to the ICC, if they investigated Israel's war crimes. So this is the Trump administration has taken things to a whole new level, but this is kind of part of a broader pattern where any effort to uphold international law when it comes to Israel, that, you know, Washington specifically, but also Canada and some other NATO countries. countries, that they target those who are slowly trying to hold Israeli officials accountable for what are, of course, vast crimes.
And Daniel, this is obviously nothing new. This is not something that's just restricted to this term. Donald Trump, we know back in his first term, he also went after another IEC team, canceling their visas. If you remember the time, that was, I believe, Fatou Ben Souda's team. He canceled their visas. He told her he's going to sanction her and target her personally for going after U.S. war crimes and probing them in Afghanistan and in Iraq in his first term. Now, her name was Fatou Ben Souda. And the funny thing is that at the time, Mossad director Yossi Cohen also was personally involved in a plot to threaten and pressure Fatou Ben Souda to drop a Palestine investigation of war crimes back in Trump's first term, obviously committed by the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine. This is a systemic. This is basically the, what do you guys call it, the modus operandi for these two entities here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's just outrageous because when the West wants to wage war, they like to weaponize human rights to do that, right? And weaponize the ICC to do that. They like to use the International Criminal Court against other countries, right? Other world leaders like Vladimir Putin, for example, mostly against African leaders, right? It used to, in fact, some people joked it was the African Criminal Court. But they don't want it applied. They don't want the ICC's rules or its gaze to be applied to Western leaders, right? It's good enough for others, but not for the West. Even though, of course, Bill Clinton's administration played a key role in helping draft the Rome Statute of the ICC, and then, of course, refused to have it ratified. All these things just show the pretextual nature of human rights when it comes to the West, right? They use it totally opportunistically.
And that abuse as using it totally opportunistically, Eves, I want to put that to you. What does this do, the selective adjudication of international law and its application, who has to answer for war crimes and who doesn't? What does this do for the rule of law?
Well, there is no rule of law in international affairs, unfortunately, and the basics of international law are just violated. This isn't new. Of course, the U.S. has done this all the time, and its allies. You know, look at the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, obviously the invasion of Iraq in 2003, crass violations of international law. So this isn't new, but what we've seen in the past 21 months is a rapid escalation on that front. And I think to the point that Dan's making about human rights just being completely politicized. I mean, it's just totally, it's so crass how, Canada's parliament will pass a unanimous resolution about supposed genocide in Ukraine, genocide against Uyghurs in China, and then enable the real genocide taking place in Gaza, everything just continues on as if this government is designed, this country is trying to uphold human rights around the world. It's just the crass double standards are so flagrant. I think more and more people are seeing those double standards around human rights talk. But if you pay attention to the dominant media in Canada, the U.S., it's only around the edges where the politicization of all this is discussed. It's throwing away the little bits of international law that were operational, and it's just might makes right. There's nothing. Israel's made it absolutely crystal clear that there's one policy, it's might makes right, and so long as they have the backing of the mightiest in the world, which we obviously see with these recent sanctions, they have. So long as they have that backing, they're just going to keep killing and killing and killing, and there's little that's going to be done.
And Dan, I'll also get your take on that. The impact of having the U.S. so blatantly try to erase the war crimes committed by Israeli leadership, try to prevent and even target individuals and organizations from administering or even trying to open the conversation to address war crimes being committed against the civilian population of over 2 million people. This cannot be good precedent, Daniel.
No, I mean, this is a frontal assault on about 150 years of well-settled international humanitarian law, right? The U.S. and Israel have been engaged in a systematic destruction of international humanitarian law, of the war, the law of war, since October 7th of 2023. Essentially, they are going out of their way on a daily basis to show that there are no limits, there are no moral or legal limits that they will recognize in terms of their behavior in prosecuting a war, right? And now we even see aid workers, so-called aid workers who are supposed to be distributing food, shooting Palestinians for sport, both Israeli and U.S. aid workers. It is absolutely disgusting. You know, I think it today is the anniversary, if I'm not mistaken, of the Soweto uprising in South Africa, in which about, I think it's 67 people were killed. And this really became a very important event, which really coalesced the world's opposition to apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israel's murdering over almost 100 people on average per day, after day. So you have at least a Soweto uprising type massacre
twice a day,
every day,
or multiple times a day.
Gentlemen, and the world is doing nothing. Yeah.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Thank you. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe. To the both of you, Mr. Eves Engler, they're joining us from Montreal, Canada, and Daniel Kovalik joining us out of Pittsburgh in the U.S. This brings us to conclude this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best, He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. I follow you no matter what. My biggest wish is to see.
is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, once more, we're here to bring you back to the real estate of everything that happens in the world. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Nasreen and Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, both of you, and thank you for coming here.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having us.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, just like the ritual of this program, without any further ado, I would like you to introduce yourself and tell us a very brief introduction about yourself.
Well, this is Zainab Askari, actually from India. For the last 10 years, I've been living in Qom, studying Hausa, and also have a linguistic background.
Very good. And you, Sister Nasreen?
And I'm Nasreen. I have studied English literature and also studied in Hausa.
Yeah. Thank you for coming here. Age is a very interesting and at the same time complicated issue to focus upon. Like, to think of my age as if I want it to be prolonged or no, if I want it to be so short, it's a very interesting thing and at the very same time very much complicated and sometimes very bitter. There was a story of a fly who lived only for hours. For some very short hours, and then that fly had to experience everything in a very short time. So that fly enjoyed every moment but was unaware of the fact that his or her life is going to end only in some more hours. Not to knowing where my life is going to end would be an interesting thing. Maybe it would push me forward into my life, into the future. But sometimes living in an area in which there are many catastrophes, in which there are many exposed wars, in which there are many bitter events happening around you, like, for example, whenever I think about children who are suffering from war, I would say that how do they look at age, their own age? Would they love it to be prolonged? Would they love it to be so long, or would they, if it was in their hand, would they love to cut it right at the moment?
Since we are not among those children, so we won't be exactly able to answer how they feel like. But yes, definitely, when life has difficulties and catastrophes, especially at the very tender age, definitely they don't understand the wisdom behind it. But since Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala very, very wisely has kept this away from us, that we don't know when we are going to die and when it's our time to go, so that we enjoy the life fully and
exactly.
We take the entire...
And we take it so seriously.
We take it so seriously. And at the same time, when there is this verse that every soul has to taste death, it's a reminder that we are not going to be here
forever. And
forever,
death is a
yeah.
must.
Yes, so the Quran basically explains this life as a field where whatever we sow, we are going to reap it in the hereafter. So it requires a lot of wisdom to understand if I have life, how to utilize it, or shall I look at it as a blessing or something like this would end very soon.
Exactly, and that story of that fly that I mentioned, that fly didn't know where his or her life is going to end. That's why that fly spent their life, just its life, only to wander around. But if they knew that their life is not going to be so long and they have only some hours, wouldn't then take it so much more valuable to themselves, like spend each and every second with much more awareness?
Mm-hmm, exactly. If I know that I'm going to die after 10 minutes,
yeah.
Of course I'm going to do...
I'm going to say the most important words I've ever wanted to say.
Yeah, we have lots of movies like this. They say, okay, imagine that he knows that he's going to die after maybe 1 hour or two, or maybe 2 days. And then you see how he changes the quality of his life.
Yeah,
he tries to do great things. He tries to help other people. He tries to do this. He tries to do that. He tries to make all of his dreams come true.
Exactly.
So why we don't we
make the
we
best out of each and mm-hmm. every moment?
Every yeah, every single moment of his life is gonna, you know, have benefits from all of those.
Yeah. So at this moment we have to go for a break, but let's just think about this point that. What if it was your choice to pick one of them, to live longer or no, to cut it shorter?
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Life is not a game, and whenever you wish you cannot just put an end to it, and whenever you wish you cannot make it even longer. When death comes, unfortunately, there's no one who could say, okay, no, this is not the right time, I cannot come with you right now. No, you have to go, and it's a must. So, we know that it has to end one day, but something happens to some people. I mean, if you think about it psychologically, it's very deep. Like, imagine us human beings, when we're so much of a kiddo, we do love our life to be so long. But as we grow older and as we see the course of life, we come to realize that sometimes death is a blessing. There were some ancient stories that tell us there were a number of people whom, based on the prayer of one of the prophets, I guess, I've heard this story, so I do not remember the very detail, but I just remember that there was a prophet, and then his people asked him to pray for them not to die at all. And then they got so old in a way that they were all weak, and they were so, you know, old and so unable to do many stuff. And then they came to the same prophet and asked him, oh, please, please pray for us to die.
Yeah, well, that's wisdom behind that.
Mm-hmm.
We never question God on why did you, like, why did someone die?
There's of course a wisdom behind death.
Yes, there's a wisdom behind
because
death.
There comes a time when I guess we no longer are able to live.
Yes, but I always have hope for a better future in life. Like I'm not among the persons who prays for death,
of course,
unless and until there is something, like, for example, if you have a prolonged life but it's full of sins, then it's way better to die than a shorter life with piety and righteousness is far better from a long life with sins. So yeah,
exactly.
It depends on the circumstances whether a person likes life or mm-hmm. death. The circumstances they have. For me, the first criteria is the same thing. Are you on the righteous path? Are you on haq? Or mm-hmm. are you on batil? Like, you have not differentiated between the two. And then other things as well, other factors as well. I mean, the financial security, the good health, and other things. I think they equally play a very important role. The illness, because I have seen, like, many families, many people who were ill, they were praying of death because they were not feeling that they were suffering themselves. They were feeling that entire family is suffering because of them.
Yeah.
So I have seen those who pray for death, why they pray for death actually, and those who pray for a long life, why do they? Like, if you ask me for a longer life, because I said I'm not among those who pray for the earlier death, I know that there's going to be a good life when there's going to be the arrival of Imam. So every day I pray for the arrival of Imam, and I'm looking for a better, just world.
Yeah, of course, inshallah, yes. You know, Sister Nasreen, there is this idea among people that only those people who are awake would wish for an end to their life, would wish for death. But do you agree? Like, I mean, what happens to a human being with this much of, you know, we have a lot of wishes and dreams in our mind,
mm-hmm.
and all of them work as a trigger of hope to keep us moving forward. So what happens to this person with this much of dreams and wishes to feel like, okay, I'm fed up and I don't want any more of this, and I wish death comes earlier?
So maybe it goes back to the quality of his life.
Mm-hmm.
you know, a long life is neither, you know, a blessing or nor a curse.
Exactly.
It's not. For these people, it's going to be called as a curse. Imagine that if I had the control of my own life, you know, that, okay, today I want to die, I die. Again, another day, I don't want to die. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did
that.
Yeah.
I have things undone.
Alhamdulillah. Thanks God. We don't have the control, you know, of our life to.
We don't have,
you know,
the button.
Press it. Okay, I want to die. And then I'm going to, you know, this is so super funny.
Yeah.
Just try to think.
So
just
it's a
use
blessing,
your brain.
Not to
yeah.
know when it comes.
Yeah. So I just think that, you know, if a long life is spent in worship, spiritual growth, serving others, and performing righteous deed, of course, it's going to be a very, very perfect, you know, every moment of it is going to be
right.
perfect and great. And
yeah.
I'm enjoying.
At least you're not going to be regretful of the things
exactly,
you did.
Exactly. Yes.
At least you know that you have done something so valuable and worthy when you're going to meet God. So let's go for a break. And then after that, we'd come to wrap it all up. Welcome back. Yes, this is Back to Reality, and this is the final stage. Well, Sister Zainab, we're talking about life and death, and then the beauty of life. So I think we've talked enough about death, and now we have to talk about life. Yes, life with all its miserable conditions sometimes with all the miseries that it would offer you, it's got something to share.
Teach you a lot
yeah.
of things. I think you're not the same person after the miseries. You're
exactly.
not the same person after facing those
after
sufferings.
The hurricanes. You're
yes,
not the same
you're not
person.
The same person. You are grown up. You are.
You're an expert sailor.
Yes, expert sailor, and you know how to survive
exactly.
the difficult waves
mm-hmm.
and difficult, you know, the temperatures or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah. Life should be enjoyed as much as it has been given to you. We never know when we die, but I think one of the very beautiful things that we don't know when we die is that we don't keep the forgivenesses, we don't keep the repentance on the end.
Yeah.
We do repent. Like, as Muslims, we are told to do
we have to
that
do it
accountability
every, day.
Every night, actually.
Yeah.
yeah. Whenever you go to sleep, because it's a form of death.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of experience it every night. So, yeah. We do it every night, and you do not keep it for a particular period. Okay, I'm going to die after this particular time, and then I will repent at the same moment. No. So this is one of the beauties, that you don't know the timings of
exactly.
this. But yes, the moments that you have in life, you should use them to for the...
Enrich the quality of our life.
Yes. Also, be righteous, be pious. Accumulate yourself with wisdom and experience. Use the opportunity for personal growth, for social
yeah.
growth, whatever you can do for the society. Use that potential for positive impact. Be a good person.
Yeah. And you, Sister Nancy.
May I finish it with a prayer?
Yes, of
yeah.
course.
It says, وَجَعَلْنِي مِمَّنْ أَطَلْتَ عُمْرَهُ وَحَسَّنْتَ عَمَلَهُ. It means that make me among those whose lives
is
you have prolonged
yeah.
and whose deeds deeds you have made virtuous.
Yeah.
So this is a
yeah.
prayer that Ahlul Bayt, our
so literally
leaders,
it would
yeah.
be this way, that help me have a longer life and do much of a better stuff.
Yes, yes.
Just as my final word, I would say that sometimes life might be so cruel, and sometimes life might show you the very aggressive face of itself. But that shouldn't be taken as the end of the world. As long as God is there, and as long as He has promised us to be with us in all the difficulties, and He said that إنما العسر يسرا, after all difficulties there would be easiness. So take this as a mission. Maybe you are in a mission. Maybe you are in a mission of being an expert, of being a narrator of a story, of being a director of a much better future, different things. It could be different things, but don't take this hard time as the end of your life. So this was all for today. I hope this would work as a trigger for your thought, as a food for your thought, and you enjoy that. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك.
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك. لتصي دليلتك once again.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In the quiet of the early morning hours on June 13th, a dramatic and unprovoked escalation rocked West Asia, sending shockwaves far beyond the region. Backed by the United States, Israel launched a sudden and highly coordinated airstrike on Iranian soil. Targets included everything from civilian neighborhoods in Tehran to key military infrastructure, and perhaps most alarmingly, Iran's nuclear facilities in Natanz and Isfahan. This attack set in motion what would become a 12-day conflict. The first day was catastrophic for Iran. In addition to losing top-ranking military officers and nuclear scientists, Tehran found itself scrambling for a response as it prepared for its sixth round of nuclear negotiations with Washington, negotiations that were, for all practical purposes, obliterated by the bombs that fell on its cities. But the story doesn't end there. They came to talk, but halfway through the negotiation, they reached for the trigger instead. Now, the question isn't just about diplomacy, it's about betrayal. What happens when a superpower trades trust for ambush? And can you ever negotiate with someone who has already decided that you shouldn't walk away alive? Mr. Ahmad Sobhani, Iran's former ambassador to Venezuela.
The fact that Americans are unreliable is nothing new. They have always been that way. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, never trusted their negotiation office from the start and said negotiations would only complicate things and not solve them. That's why direct talks were refused. The talks we had were indirect, but even then, their deceit was evident. In five rounds of negotiations, Trump always claimed progress was being made, while in reality, there was none. They had ulterior motives, and by attacking Iran in the middle of negotiations, they showed the world their true colors. Inside Iran, some believed negotiations with the US could yield results, but they didn't realize you can't negotiate with a wolf.
What began as a U.S. distancing itself from Israel's attack quickly escalated into a direct American strike on Iran's nuclear sites. On June 22nd, the U.S. launched airstrikes on Natanz, Isfahan, and Fordo, using bunker-busting munitions to target Iran's most secure underground facilities. Officially, the strikes were framed as a preemptive move to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. But just weeks earlier, both U.S. intelligence and IAEA reports had confirmed Iran had no such plans. Mr. Soheil Jamshidpour, an Iranian political expert.
Israel and the U.S. Claimed that the nature of the attacks were preemptive, and it was a means to hinder Iran's efforts to develop and manufacture a nuclear bomb. Now, the question is, does a preemptive strike have any position in international law and regulations?
Iran is a member of the NPT and all nuclear non-proliferation conventions. This means Iran considers itself bound by all the rules governing nuclear activity and operates within the internationally accepted framework. In other words, all its activities have been under the supervision for the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, no country has welcomed the inspectors more than Iran. Now, suppose Iran did something unacceptable. The IAEA reports it to the Board of Governors, which may refer it to the UN Security Council for further review and decision. It's completely unacceptable and against all international laws for the Zionist regime and the U.S., both nuclear armed, to suddenly decide to attack Iran's nuclear facilities and call it a preemptive strike. Israel, which has hundreds of nuclear warheads, is not an NPT member, and expressing concern over Iran's peaceful program makes the whole story ridiculous and surreal.
The attack sparked a powerful and decisive Iranian response, Operation True Promise 3, and left the U.S. media and political landscape deeply divided. CNN discussed the potential $30 billion investment in Iran's civilian nuclear program, while Donald Trump dismissed it as fake and warned of more military action. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mark Rubio pushed for direct talks with Tehran. This fractured approach reveals not just a lack of strategic coherence, but also growing frustration with Congress, as Democrats criticize the White House's OPEC decision-making in a crisis that's far from over. This is Mr. Sayed Reza Sadrul Hosseini, an Iranian senior expert on international relations.
What do you think are some of the consequences for Netanyahu and Trump after the attack on Iran?
Even before the attack on Iran, Trump was not particularly popular globally. After the attack, his popularity, even at home, reached its lowest point because the American people do not want their country dragged into another foolish war. The same holds true in the occupied territories. Not only Netanyahu's opponents, but many of those who work with him believe that the attack on Iran would accelerate the Israeli Prime Minister's exit from power. These are just short-term consequences of the attack.
When a reality TV star took the White House, global politics became a stage, and the script changed dramatically. So who do you get to run the world's nuclear watchdog? According to some, a man with more ties to Mossad than to transparency. Hence the question arises, how can an agency demand trust when its own leader seems to have lost it? In the wake of the Israeli and U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, a critical question is emerging. What role did the International Atomic Energy Agency play in escalating this crisis?
At the center of the controversy is IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi, whose handling of Iran's nuclear file has sparked fierce criticism and raised alarms about the neutrality of international oversight. Iranian officials say Grossi is aligned too closely with Western powers, and particularly with Israel, in a way that undermines the agency's impartiality. The tension between Tehran and the IAEA has been simmering for years, but it reached a boiling point in the days before the first Israeli airstrikes. A controversial report from the IAEA highlighting uranium enrichment levels in Iran was quickly used by Israel as justification for its military actions. Although Grossi later acknowledged that the IAEA had found no evidence of Iran pursuing nuclear weapons, the damage was already done. The report had been cited to support a resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors accusing Iran of non-compliance, effectively setting the stage for the Israeli attacks that followed. Grossi's actions, along with his failure to condemn the attacks, have severely undermined the IAEA's credibility. Iran, long a partner in the agency's nuclear oversight, now sees Grossi's IAEA as a tool of Western political interests. This shift led Iran's Majlis to vote to suspend cooperation with the IAEA, signaling a deepening distrust. Mr. Ruhollah Modabber, another Iranian political expert, talked to us about the destructive role of the IAEA.
What is very important is the role of the IAEA as a factor in this hybrid war. Before the Israeli aggression, IAEA Director Grossi gave false reports and accusations to some Board of Governors members, which led to the joint resolution by France, Britain, Germany, and the U.S. against Iran. While the Zionist regime crossed all red lines and invaded Iranian territory, killing defenseless women and children, assassinating senior Iranian commanders, and attacking critical infrastructure, military bases, residential areas, hospitals, and nuclear facilities, staying in the NPT and continuing cooperation with the IAEA has no meaning, especially since the IAEA took no action to defend Iran. Reliable information shows the agency gave intelligence on nuclear scientists to Israel for assassination. Grossi's role as an intelligence agent is clear, and the agency itself acts as a coordinated espionage network